was done a lot of deliberation. Can we just get to a process of reading the bill, the drafted amendment, clause by clause? The reason why I'm saying that, you are all aware that you should we should have been finalized this bill last week and then maybe debated in the House this week, but unfortunately we couldn't. So we have requested an extension from Parliament to deal with this bill this week. And then we need to make sure that we adopt it. If there are any few, because I don't think there's much, there could be few issues that we need to attend to. So those few issues must not hinder the progress of adopting the bill with amendments that are going to be worked out by the office of the chairperson and then confirm them to the members before the bill is printed out. So I think that's the proposal. Honorable Mhalaba.
Thanks, Chair. Even though we definitely agree that we've worked extensively on this, I'm for reading the bill clause by clause. We have five very technical. I don't think it will change the look of this of the bill per se. So I just want your indulgence whether will we do it as we go clause by clause or do I put it up front so that the legal gurus can work on it while we are going clause by clause. I'm at your mercy on that one. But they are not much deviating. It's not thing that we can go, I think we will go to all with. It's something that is just logical and practical that we just canvass.
I would suggest that let's get to clause by clause and then you raise that issue. Yes, yes. State law advisor is going to lead us on this process. Mongi, over to you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think we all have a version of the bill which has been printed by CREDA. That is the revised version, and it reads, Rental Housing Amendment Bill as presented by the Portfolio Committee on Human Settlements, National Assembly. It's B21B2011. So that is the bill that we're going to be discussing today. And there's no A and a B and a B bill because it is the redraft of the committee, so it's going to be that process. On page 2, it's a long title. Yes. The one is the B21B. B21B, 2011. Yes, that's the final product. All have that draft. Okay, the long title seeks to amend the Rental Housing Act 1999. I'm not sure if I should read it through and. Okay, to amend the Rental Housing Act 1999 so as to substitute and insert certain definitions, to fully stipulate the duties of government, to set out the rights and obligations of tenants and landlords in a coherent manner, to require leases to be in writing, to extend the application of Chapter 4 to all provinces, to require MECs to establish rental housing tribunals, to extend the powers of the rental housing tribunals, to provide for an appeal process, to require all municipalities to have rental housing information offices to provide for norms and standards related to rental housing, to extend offences, and to provide for matters connected there, which is a long title of the bill. Clause 1 is deals with the amendment of Section 1 of Act 50 of 1999 and reads as follows. Section 1 of the Rental Housing Act 1999, herein after referred to as the Principal Act, is hereby amended by the insertion before the definition of dwelling of the following definition, and we inserting a definition of arbitrary eviction, a definition of habitability. I'm going to read this definition. Arbitrary eviction refers to depriving a tenant of occupation of a dwelling without an order of court made after considering all the relevant circumstances. Item B, by the insertion after the definition of financial institution of the following definition and its habitability, refers to a dwelling that is safe and suitable for living in and includes adequate space protection from the elements and other threats to health, physical safety of the tenant's household and visitors, and structurally a sound building, and habitable has a corresponding meaning. Paragraph C reads as follows, by the substitution for the definition of head of department of the following definition. Head of department means the officer in charge of a department of the provincial government responsible for, in bold and brackets, housing and underlined human settlements in the province. So the intention is just to substitute housing with human settlements. Paragraph D, by the insertion of, after the definition of lease of the following definitions. Local municipality means a municipality as defined in the local government Municipal Systems Act 2000, Act No. 32 of 2000. Maintenance refers to such repairs and upkeep as may be required to ensure that a dwelling's habitability does not constitute an unfair practice, and maintain has a corresponding meaning. Paragraph E, by the substitution for the definition of minister of the following definition, also the intention is just to substitute housing for human settlements. Hence, housing is in bold and human settlements is underlined. The next definition is the definition of prescribed. It means prescribed by regulation. And we've bolded by the MEC by noticing the Gazette, because the intention is it must be the minister who must make regulations and not the MEC. So that was the intention for the amendment. Adopt this section as it is. Honourable member? Agreed? The regulations. Regulations are prescribed by the minister.
Chairperson, I've just noticed something, and I might be wrong here, but just in the under definitions, in the original act, there was the word authority under rental housing information office means an office established by a local authority. I'm not sure anymore if our discussion said that that needed to be municipality or whether we left that word as authority.
Not long I use the local authority. Yeah. By using the municipality.
Because that has not been captured. That's why I'm asking the question.
Because the municipalities are the ones, local municipalities, are the ones, definition now, rather than local authority.
Yeah,
we've made, hence we're having a definition of local municipality, and throughout the bill we've substituted local authority with local municipality. And there is an umbrella provision in on page 12, clause 19, that seeks to substitute the expression local authority wherever it occurs in the Act. So it has been taken care of.
I want to be clear about this one. This F, by substitution of the definition of prescribed, of the following definition. Prescribed means prescribed by regulation by MEC.
Regulations are prescribed by the minister. By the substitution for the definition of minister of the following, okay, minister of human settlement. And by the substitution for the definition of prescribed of the following, means prescribed by regulations. Yeah. Can you clarify this one?
Oh.
The words, you know, if you look at the words which are bold and are in brackets, that means they are being omitted from the Act. Why are you not putting the minister? Yeah, but in terms of the bill and also in terms of the Act, when you're making to reference, you are going to delete prescribed by regulations, and then you delete the bold ones. That's what we are implying here. Okay. Now it's going to read, without the bold, it's going to read prescribed means prescribed by regulation, meaning that the minister, it is important the minister to prescribe, because in terms of the Act, only the minister can make regulation. So that's it. Prescribed by the who prescribed? Ugabini. It could be prescribed by the regulation. There can be prescription again by the Act. I'm not sure.
You know, just for emphasis, Chairperson, we can say prescribed means prescribed by the minister, just to be sure, you know, so that everyone is covered.
We are referring to the regulations. Yeah. So the regulations is only the minister who prescribes. So let us be clear on that one.
Now it's going to read prescribed means prescribed by regulation by the minister. Underlined.
Prescribed means prescribed regulations by the minister. Ne? Can you just look? Mom?
Because if you are saying only the minister can prescribe regulation, so if you are saying it's prescribed by regulation, really it means regulation that has been prescribed by the minister. So I think I'm going to say
kaloku bekuqala bekhona la MEC ngoku na once kukhona ke aba bantu abazawuthatha iadvantage ngoba loku bebeziprescribe iregulation. So that is why ifuneka ibe clear from the Act. But into endifuna ukuyichecka mna uprescribed, mna bendizawuthi prescribed by the regulation and by the Act and the regulation, because whatever that is in, I don't know.
The minister cannot prescribe anything, any regulation outside of the Act. So the Act takes the principal approach in this one. So we'd rather say prescribed by the Act. And you see the issue of the minister. These MECs, in some other provinces they call them ministers. In others they call them MECs.
Stop it.
No, I want to find out.
No.
I'm going.
Oh, okay.
I want the clarity to say, yes, to say the minister, do we? We have to be clear that exactly. Why are you shooting me down for?
I understand your point.
Sure.
I understand your point. 100%. No. Let's not go further.
Let's not go further. Let's agree prescribed by the Act. So the Act, what, yes. Let's agree on that one.
I was gonna propose Chairperson to make a link to that empowering provision that allows the minister to make regulation. To say prescribed means prescribed by regulation in terms of Section 15. If it's Section 15, then it makes it clear now, because that section stipulates that the minister must make regulation.
Let's not discuss the matter, because we better not go share with that. Let it be a matter of
on page 3, amendment of Section 2 of Act 50 of 1999. Section 2 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the division in subsection 2 of the word "and" at the end of paragraph C, and the insertion of the word "and" at the end of paragraph D, and the addition of the following paragraph. So we have to read this together with the Principal Act so that you can see where exactly we're inserting the amendment. I'm not sure if you have already done that during the deliberations. And we're adding paragraph E, provide legal mechanisms to protect the rights of tenants and landlords against illegal actions by the other party by affording speedy means of redress. And the second item, paragraph B, is by the addition after subsection 4. Of the following subsections. We're adding subsection 5 and 6, and it reads as follows. The minister must A, monitor and assess the impact of the application of this act on landlords and tenants, and more specifically the impact of on poor and vulnerable tenants. And Roman 2, the performance of tribunals and rental housing information offices. Paragraph B, the minister must develop such relief measures and other social programs as part of the policy framework on rental housing referred to in subsection 3, as he or she deems necessary to alleviate hardship that may be suffered by tenants. C. Develop programs, directives and guidelines or amend or augment the policy framework on rental housing referred to in subsection 3 in such a manner as he or she is fit to facilitate effective performance by tribunals and rental housing information offices. In paragraph D, annually report to the National Assembly on the promotion of rental housing property envisaged in sections 2 and 3. Subsection 6, for the purposes of subsection 5, the minister may define criteria based on age, income or another form or degree of vulnerability that apply to such tenants or group of tenants, and amend or augment the policy framework on rental housing referred to in subsection 3 in such a manner as he or she sees fit. That's clause 2.
Agreed. Yes. Continue with
clause D, annual report to the nation on the promotion of rental housing property. Does it cover the issue of saying because of part of the problem of this bill will be to popularize it, because of you will be having people who would not know that we've got this amended rental bill. Does it cover the issue of making it a popularizing it into the targeted market? I'm not sure how it covers that one. Does it talk about that? Because if it says the minister must report to Parliament on the promotion of rental housing property Is it as an asset, or is it about the rental bill and the impact on it on the tenants and the landlords per se? Okay.
Response, I understand you.
Chairperson, if I may take this question, this reporting
also the progress. I think you are referring to progress. Andy. Yes.
Chairperson, if I may answer, this reporting relates to the duties that are being placed by this bill on the national government in terms of both sections 2 and 3 of the Principal Act. Section 2 deals with the responsibility of government to promote rental housing, where they must promote the stable and growing market. They must improve conditions, they must encourage investment, they must correct distorted patterns, etc. So there's a number of duties placed on them, including the development of this policy, which must do all these things that we've now added. Furthermore, Section 3 deals with provision of rental housing property and measures that the government must take to increase that. So on all of those aspects, there must be an annual report to the National Assembly. So it is on all the duties that the National Department has in terms of this Act that they must report back to this committee. So popularizing the Act will be a part of that, because I think mostly this will be done through your rental housing information offices. We're now on the ground. We will start distributing information about rental housing. And on that aspect, the minister has to monitor and evaluate the effectiveness of those rental housing information offices and report back on that effectiveness to this committee. So, yes.
I think it's specifically relating to the housing property. So I think that is your concern. Yes, in the bill itself, it's just limited. We don't mean to say, mention the function, but I think the concern of Honorable Mkhala, this one only relates to the housing property. They only refer to only Section 2 and 3. So I don't know how to...
If you look at the bill on page 3, row 29, it starts with the minister must monitor and assess the impact of the application of this Act, and it deals on landlords and tenants, which are the main people dealing with this. So that will be how this Act impacts on people on the ground. Secondly, the performance of the tribunals and the rental housing. So we are not saying necessarily the impact of the Act on tribunals and rental housing, but their performance, which will be informed by the Act. So the impact of this Act on the ground must be monitored, must be evaluated, and must be included in the report that comes back to the committee.
But we will take it further up, because of the issue that I'm putting across, Chair, to make it simple and clear, is that once this bill becomes into effect, there would be existing lease agreements that are verbal, for example. What are we going to do to make sure that those leases become, effective? Or that to make sure that this bill become effective? Because of here I'm talking about public popularization of this bill. Because of as we speak, once we enact it into law, there would still be those leases that are verbal. What happens to their status? And how do we make sure that we popularize so that when the minister comes and report, tells us the impact of this bill on those leases? Am I clear, Chair?
I think the issue that we are raising, we have raised it in the last meeting to say, because the legal practitioners, they told us that this bill is going to be implementable for the new lease agreement. Our concern, we said, no, we can't live into South Africa. There has to be a period where we are saying we are giving the rental industry to make sure that those agreements are reviewed. So I take your point. Maybe it has been addressed. They must tell us where they have addressed that issue, because it's very critical. There has to be a window period. Yeah. So is there any area where you have addressed this matter, so that we take note of that? If it is not here, make sure that it is addressed. But now, I think you have to respond also to this issue of being concentrating on this housing property of rental housing annual report. Maybe if you can look at this, maybe you can rephrase it, I don't know, to assist in a comprehensive manner that tries to address all the issues, but in a simpler and brief. Okay.
Chairperson, if I can refer the members to page 12 of the bill, there is a clause in there, clause 20, which deals with transitional provisions. The transitional provisions pertain to this amendment bill, and what we are saying is that where there are any additional or amended obligations imposed upon a landlord or tenant. Now, number one, that is that the lease must be in writing. This becomes effective 6 months from the date of commencement of this act. And the reason for that 6 months period was to make sure that people become aware of this requirement and then implements it. What we can do, because I think the concern was twofold, the fact that it must change, but also that this committee would like to know about the changes, is that we can amend, if I can take you back to page 3 of the bill, row 45, paragraph B in clause 2, and I'm referring to now the subsection that we are changing is 5, paragraph D, which is in row 44, it starts in row 44. We can change that to read, annually report to the National Assembly on the promotion of rental housing property envisaged in sections 2 and 3, as well as on the implementation of the Act, which will mean that anything that the Act, as it is implemented, there must be a report on that. So that will be your progress report that you are talking about.
Yes, I concur, you know, with, you know, the provision, but I'm worried about the fact that really my minister is going to be extremely busy, you know, under this provision.
Talk about the minister. The act talk about the minister. The minister does not do the actual job. You are doing the actual job. The department, don't come up with stories. Minister, I was saying that for a tough. Unani pa, ni na baza ukichima, ni wakwa forget about it. They're not those the stories now.
The 6 months clause of the transitional provision, is it adequate? The 6 months transitional clause, is it adequate? 6 or 12 months?
We can say the minimum, and then we have the maximum, because we have to. Yeah, 6 months. Let's say the minimum, so that we give people, yeah, it's fine. Nobody's going to die on this one, because when this, the department is doing its oversight, it's going to be hard on them to say, let's try and meet the deadline. At least let's put maximum and minimum, and minimum and maximum. Yes, yes.
Okay, continue with this. The next one is amendment of section 303. Section 3 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the addition after subsection 4 of the following subsections. Subsection 5 and subsection 6, and it reads as follows. National government must develop and fund programs to train members of the tribunals and officials appointed in terms of section 14.2. Subsection 6, provincial governments must financially assist local municipalities not yet on level 3 accreditation in establishing rental housing information offices as contemplated in section 4.
Manager, may I ask a question here? May I ask a question on 5? Mhlawumbe, I know by right, Master City, national government must develop and set aside adequate budget. When you say fund, if it's, I don't know, mhlawumbe, if the manner in the understanding I, to train members, yes. And then, provincial government must financially assist local municipalities not yet on level 3. Yes, this one I agree with. But, okay, can you come?
Yeah, you're right. It must give us the leeway when we come into the triple B, the BRR, where we can set aside. So here you just have to help us with legal semantics. If we feel that we must set aside funds for the development of this program to put it into the department. Oh, no, it's just an English semantic word. Don't worry about it. So I agree. They must just help us to say if the committee wants to set aside funds from the national department fiscus, we can be able to do that with our budget review.
In fact, they have said so, that they are going to fund. But in a manner, at least, Ula, we can manage.
Chair, I think that the main focus here is about capacity building. So whilst you're translating that terminology fund, isn't it directed towards capacity building?
You can build the capacity through human or financial resources. That is why the budget, when you set aside budget, it's going to encompass human resource part of it as well as financial resources. Is any meeting in my quarter?
Yeah, we have a proposal, Chairperson. Okay. Sub 5 will read now, national government must develop and set aside a budget to fund programs to train members.
That all sounds fine. I'm just wondering whether all these cross-references have been checked. As, for example, tribunals and officials appointed in terms of Section 42. And I think, yes, that's what we need to do.
Thank you.
Provincial government must financially assist local municipalities not yet on level 3 accreditation in establishing rental. So let's go to 14. 14 refers to rental housing information offices. Is
thank you, Chairperson. If I can also take you back on page 3 to subsection 5, it says it will now read, national government must develop and set aside budget to fund programs to train members of, one, the tribunals, and two, officials appointed in terms of section 14.2. So it covers for tribunals as well as the officials. And then if you look at the 14.2, it indicates appoint or designate officials to carry out duties pertaining to rental housing information office. So it covers tribunal members and the members that, or the officials that deal with the rental housing information. Fourteen two is on page 10 of the bill. It starts in row 18.
Section 13. It's 13. It's not 14.
Chairperson, if we just keep in mind, because we're working with an amendment bill, the clause that we are dealing with that amends section 14 is clause 13. But that is clause 13 of this amendment bill. So when this amendment bill is incorporated into the Act, we will be dealing with section 14. So that is the difference between the 13 and the 14. So apologies for that misunderstanding.
Next amendment is on page 4, is clause 4, amendment of chapter 3. Chapter 3 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution for the heading of the following heading. So, relations between, it is in bold and it is in square brackets, meaning that it's being omitted from the bill, and the words underlined are inserted. Rights and obligations of tenants and landlords. That's the amendment in clause 4. The next amendment is on clause 5. In clause 5, it amends section 4 of the Principal Act. It reads as follows, section 4 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the deletion of subsections 2, 3, 4, and 5. The next one is clause 6. It's an insertion of sections 4A and 4 capital letter B. And it reads as follows. The following sections are hereby inserted in the Principal Act after section 4. Section 4A deals with the rights and obligations of tenants and reads as follows. 1. Tenants have the right to receive a written receipt from the landlord for all payments received by the landlord from the tenant, which receipt must A, be dated, B, clearly indicate the address, including the street number and further description, if necessary, of a dwelling in respect of which payment is made, C, indicate whether payment has been made for rental areas, deposit, or otherwise, and D, specify the period for which payment is made. Sub 2, tenants may request the landlord during the period of the lease to provide him or her with a return proof in respect of interest accrued on the deposit paid. 3, on receipt of the lease, tenants have the right to receive payment of the deposit and interest without, and yeah, sorry, it's an expiration of the lease. Tenants have the right to receive payment of the deposit and interest without any deduction or set off within 7 days of expiration of the lease, provided that where the tenant A is liable to the landlord for any amounts under the said lease, including the reasonable cost of repairing damage to the dwelling during the lease period and the cost of replacing lost keys, the landlord may deduct such amounts and refund the balance of the deposit and interest to the tenant not later than 14 days from the restoration of the dwelling to the landlord, or B, fails to make himself or herself available for an inspection contemplated in subsection 6, the landlord may deduct any amount to recover any damages or loss which occurred during the tenancy and refund the balance of the deposit and interest to the tenant not later than 21 days from restoration of the dwelling to the landlord. Sub 4, tenants have the right to inspect the relevant receipts which indicate costs which the landlord incurred, as contemplated in subsection 3, as proof of such costs incurred by the landlord. 5, tenants have a right in the presence of the landlord and before tenant moves into the dwelling to have the dwelling inspected to A, to determine the landlord's responsibility for rectifying any defects or damage, and B, register any defects or damage as provided for in section 5-7. Sub 6.
I just want to go back to these days of the refund. We've got 7 days, then we've got 14 days, then we've got 21 days. And I know there are different functions happening there. Are we not contradicting ourselves a little bit, especially with the 21 days? If the tenant, you know, doesn't present himself or herself.
Yeah. That's three different things, Honourable Member. If you read the opening words of sub 3, the 7 days is that they have a right to receive their deposit within 7 days of the expiry of the lease. And then we've got a condition. In the event of the tenant, if the tenant is liable for any damages, then the landlord has a right to deduct the amount, and such must happen within not later than 14 days. So the 21 days as well, if the tenant fails to avail himself for the inspection, the landlord may deduct the amount to recover any damages. All of this happens at the end of the lease. If they are not availing themselves for the inspection, then within 21 days after that, not later than 21 days, then the landlord has the right to return. Those are the three separate issues which I'm not talking to each other.
No, I think they're clear because in the bill, there's an area where it is proposed that 3 days before you leave to vacate as a tenant, you have to make sure that that house is inspected jointly by yourself and the landlord. So that 7 days, if you have inspected the house 3 days before, you have to get your deposit and your interest. If you are found clear of any this,
because it covers three possible scenarios that can happen. That's why you must put dates on each one. The very good scenario is 7 days, when there's no dispute, nothing is happening, you get your deposit. In case there are other issues, then it must be settled within 14 days. If there are other further issues, then it's been 1 day. So it's covering itself in terms of scenarios. And again, it should be practical so that it's applicable on the ground in terms of time frame.
So it moves from day 1 to day 21. It's not saying 7 days separated, and then you bring another 14 days, and then you bring another 21 days. I think, or you want that to be clear, maybe it's not clear.
It's clear the way we've got it there, but I'm actually querying the rationale behind it, because your 14 days I can see that rationale between the 7 and the 14 days. But then for 21 days, just because the tenant hasn't been present or something, why isn't that still 14 days? That's the query.
To the tenants who have been complaining about the vulnerable people here. So I think this is fair, because the landlord could not be taken to court to say he has done unfair. He has been unfair to the tenant. So at least that 21 gives ample time for no one to come and complain again, because ample time has been given to that particular person. I think this one is clear. Mama Jobe?
And I think in addition, you see, the last one, the 21 days, is necessary. Because if, for instance, the landlord... I say if the landlord is a reasonable person, friendly, it could still give him time to contact the tenant, and they could solve the problem. But the 21 days for me is all right, because there's a problem here. Somebody has not presented themselves. You don't know what the reason for not presenting themselves is. In case they're in hospital, in case they're sick, and so on and so forth. So the 21 days allows for such things, in my opinion.
Margaret, carry on. But where we were, we have dealt with B5B. We have dealt, okay, continue with your 6.
Sub 6, 3 days or less before the expiration of a lease, the tenant must make himself or herself available to conduct a joint inspection of the dwelling at a time convenient to the landlord and the tenant, with a view to ascertaining if any damage was caused to the dwelling during the tenant's occupation thereof, provided that a failure by the landlord to inspect the dwelling in the presence of the tenant as contemplated in this subsection is deemed to be an acknowledgement by the landlord that the dwelling is in good and proper state of repair, and the landlord will have no further claim against the tenant. Or B, failure by the tenant to respond to the landlord's request for an inspection as contemplated in this subsection will result in the landlord conducting an inspection without the tenant's presence, after which the landlord may deduct any damages or loss which occurred during the tenancy as contemplated in subsection 3B. Sub 7, a tenant has the right during the lease period to privacy, and should the landlord wish to exercise his or her right of inspection, the inspection must be done in a reasonable manner after reasonable notice to the tenant. Sub 8, tenant's rights against the landlord include his or her right not to have A, his or her person or dwelling searched, B, his or her property searched, C, his or her possession seized, except in terms of a law of general application and having obtained a ruling by a tribunal or an order of court, or D, the privacy of his or her communication infringed. Sub 9, the rights set out in subsection 8 apply equally to members of the tenant's household and to visitors of the tenant. Sub 10, tenants are liable for rental and other costs agreed on in the lease upon the due date, but for costs other than those agreed to in the lease, tenants are only liable upon proof of factual expenditure by the landlord. That is the new section for capital letter A that deals with the rights and obligations of tenants.
Subsection 10. The tenants are liable for rental and other costs agreed on in the lease upon the due date, but for costs, I think from it should end there, but for costs other than those agreed on the lease, okay? tenants are only liable upon proof of factual expenditure, what would be coming after what is agreed on the written lease? If you've got a written lease and then it's got all the costs that the tenant is liable for, which other cost might come? I mean, if you've got the lease and you've got a contract with the landlord, it can't be that come the time and then the landlord will say there are other costs. Here is the proof of it. So we must remove that one.
Delete it.
There's no other factual thing that the landlord can put because we must delete that one.
Delete it. Thank you. So we are agreeing with this. I mean, can you read it for
it,
the last?
It ends to the due date. But for costs other than those agreed on the lease, tenants are only liable. No. You must delete from due date. Yeah, from but you just delete the whole thing. Tenants are liable for rental and other costs agreed on in the lease upon the due date. That's it. Yeah.
The next one is rights and obligations of landlords.
Just before we do move on, we are trying to cover the tenant here, and whilst I agree with what we've just done, I think it is important to keep in the factual evidence of what has been spent. I think that is a right that a tenant does have. Relating to what was agreed in the original agreement, okay? But I don't think we need to take that upon proof of factual expenditure by the landlord out.
No.
The argument here is that a landlord cannot come after you've got a written lease agreement and say, here is a proof of the additionals that happened. That is the thing, and that's what this clause is saying. It's saying a landlord can come and say, apart from our written lease contract, here is another factual proof of the cost that you've incurred. It can be.
Cut it off now. But after the set of a lease, if there are any other costs that will relate to labor state of your car, the damages. So that will need the proof. But in terms of the lease, it ends here. Yes. The lease. No. If I come to you, I sign a lease agreement that I'm going to pay so much by this term. That's the lease. No. It does not fit in here. So that is why we are deleting it here. It does not fit in here. Carry on.
Section 4B, 1, a landlord may require a tenant before moving into the dwelling to pay a deposit which A, may not exceed an amount equivalent to an amount specified in the lease agreement or otherwise agreed to between the parties. B, must be invested by the landlord in an interest-bearing account with a financial institution, provided that the rate applicable to such account may not be less than the rate applicable to a savings account with that financial institution. C, must, subject to subsections 3 or 6, be repaid to the tenant with such interest at the rate applicable to such account on the expiration of the lease as contemplated in subsection 3 or 6. And D, shall, together with any interest accrued to it, not form part of the assets of the insolvent or deceased estate of the landlord in the event of the insolvency or death of the landlord. Sub 2, upon request from the tenant during the period of the lease, the landlord must provide him or her with written proof of interest accrued on the deposit referred to in subsection 1, provided that where the landlord is a registered estate agent as provided for in the Estate Agency Affairs Act 1976, Act Number 112 of 1976, the deposit and any interest thereon shall be dealt with in accordance with the provisions of that Act.
What are those provisions?
That Act is already dealing with the
Yes, it deals with the processes whereby you've nominated an agent to deal with your trust. So they open a trust account and invest the deposit there. Sub 3, on the expiration of the lease, the landlord A must, when no amounts are due and owing to the landlord in terms of the lease, refund the deposit together with the accrued interest in respect thereof to the tenant without any deduction or set off within 7 days of expiration of the lease. B, may apply such deposit and interest towards the payment of all amounts for which the tenant is liable under the said lease, including reasonable cost of repairing damage to the dwelling during the lease period and the cost of replacing lost keys and the balance of the deposit and interest, if any, must be refunded to the tenant by the landlord not later than 14 days of restoration of the dwelling to the landlord. And C, must make available to the tenant for inspection the relevant receipts which indicate costs which the landlord incurred, as contemplated in paragraph B, as proof of such costs incurred by the landlord. Sub 4, the tenant and the landlord must jointly, before the tenant moves into the dwelling, inspect the dwelling to ascertain the existence or not of any defect or damage therein, with a view to determining the landlord's responsibility for rectifying any defect or damage, or with a view to registering such defects or damage as provided for in section 5.7. Sub 5, 3 days or less before the expiration of the lease, the landlord and the tenant must arrange a joint inspection of the dwelling at a mutually convenient time to ascertain if any damage was caused to the dwelling during the tenant's occupation thereof. Provided that, A, failure by the landlord to inspect the dwelling in the presence of the tenant as contemplated in this subsection is deemed to be an acknowledgement by the landlord that the dwelling is in good and proper state of repair, and the landlord will have no further claim against the tenant, who must be refunded the full deposit plus interest by the landlord as contemplated in subsection 3A, or B, should the tenant fail to respond to the landlord's request for inspection, as contemplated in this subsection, the landlord must inspect the dwelling within 7 days from the expiration of the lease in order to assess any damages or loss which occurred during the tenancy. Subsection 6, the landlord, in the circumstances contemplated in subsection 5b, without detracting from any other right or remedy of the landlord, dash A, may deduct from the tenant's deposit and interest the reasonable cost of repairing damage to the dwelling and the cost of replacing lost keys. B, must refund the balance of the deposit and interest, if any, after deduction of the amounts contemplated in paragraph A, to the tenant not later than 21 days after the expiration of the lease. And C, must make available the relevant receipts which indicate costs which the landlord incurred as contemplated in paragraph A to the tenant for inspection as proof of such costs incurred by the landlord. Sub 7, should the tenant vacate the dwelling before the expiration of the lease without notice to the landlord, the lease is deemed to have expired on the date that the landlord established that the tenant had vacated the dwelling. But in such event, the landlord retains all his or her rights arising from the tenant's breach of the lease. Sub 8, a landlord may inspect the dwelling during the course of the lease, but in doing so must respect the tenant's right to privacy during the lease period and may only exercise his or her right of inspection in a reasonable manner after giving reasonable notice to the tenant. 9, a landlord's right against a tenant include the right to prompt and regular payment of rental or charges that may be payable in terms of a lease. B, recover unpaid rental or any other amount that is due and payable where the tenant fails or refuses to make payment on demand after obtaining a ruling by the tribunal or an order of court of law. C, terminate the lease in respect of rental housing property on grounds that do not constitute unfair practice
and are specified in the lease. D, on termination of a lease, have the tenant vacate the rental housing property immediately upon expiration of the lease and to receive the rental housing property in a good state of repair, say for fair wear and tear. And two, where the tenant fails or refuses to vacate the dwelling, evict the tenant from the rental housing property after having obtained an order of court. And E, claim compensation for damage to the rental housing property and damage to any other improvements on the land on which the dwelling is situated, if any, caused by the tenant and a member of the tenant's household or visitor of the tenant. 10. Landlords must ensure that the provisions of sections 5, 6, 7, and 8 regarding the lease are complied with. Sub 11. A landlord must provide a tenant with a dwelling that is in a habitable condition, as well as maintain the existing structure of the dwelling and, where possible, facilitate provision of utilities to the dwelling. That is clause 6.
This clause relates to the formal rental industry. Sitting our abantu basemakhaya, because our abantu aba rentisa for one room, in terms of this account, you know, it ukubhala kona, it's not a problem. We need written. But in terms of this account that has to be opened, I think we need to have something that talks to that. I don't know. Because if you are saying, Lambda only one room, only a la teacher, etala pawaki, I have a account here. So what do you say? Because people will stick on this when they want their interest. So it's a well established now rental market. And this bill, can you think of something that can relate to that sector?
Chairperson, can we just point out to the committee that the paragraph that deals with the interest-bearing account, that is on page 5, row 29. It simply says it must be invested by the landlord in an interest-bearing account with a financial institution. That means it can be with the post office, it can be with any institution that is registered as a financial institution. It also does not have to be a separate account. It can thus be in the bank account of the landlord, his savings account with his bank or his check account with his bank. It can be held in that account. It doesn't have to be separate, as long as it is invested in order for it to be able to earn interest.
Does this subsection clarify that? So that Nalamdupa, I understand. Does it really clarify this sub clause? Ibone na ulamtu. Apa uchina sizo besinge eko tina apa. Lamtu pa wili yoko nginda ufelagui regulations. I think we have to put something first. We normally say this should further be elaborated or clarified with rules. I mean with regulations. But I don't know how you're going to put it. Yeah.
Chair, I think you are correct, because it has always been our emphasis, you know, to our colleagues as well and our friends, to say the emphasis and the applicability of this piece of legislation is not only focusing on your well-established rental market. It also applies to the backyard rental in our townships, in the rural areas. So when we insert certain provisions into this particular act, it's
going to be extremely difficult for them to expect an old grading in a township to go and establish an account, interest-bearing account. And it needs from time to time to be given to provide a tenant with an interest and give information in relation to that. So we need, of course, Chairperson, you know, you're correct, to have a look at the particular aspect.
Can you put a job? I don't know. I'm your legal person. I just think, and I want you to implement what I think. Yeah, my thoughts. Can you put it somewhere? Whether you say EE regulation should expand on this one, or you will see. Just something that relates to that. Because abantu bazofuna lo mthetho umuntu akho implement ka ungakho easy. Let's make this to be easier.
If we can make the following change, paragraph B, row 29 on page 5, must be invested by the landlord in an interest-bearing account with a financial institution or as prescribed by regulation. Then, provided the rate applicable to an account may not be less than the rate applicable.
And, as specified, the regulations are going to specify. Okay?
I'm just worried, if we say and, that means that it will always have to be in an interest-bearing account. So what we are doing here is we're actually saying that in general we want this to be in an interest-bearing account. If the minister can find a different way to ensure that there's interest earned on the deposit without it being in a financial institution's account, then that will be applicable. So therefore, the regulations, we are giving the minister the authority to some extent actually amend this principal act. Otherwise, it will always be interest-bearing account.
You know, Chairperson, I think here what Shaman is trying to do in paragraph B, the or as may be prescribed is giving an option for those instances of those illiterate people who cannot read or who cannot go and open an account. The minister will assist the regulation.
It must be a separate clause. Let's not interfere with B as it is. You rather, maybe you can continue to have another sentence that clarifies that in a condition, kunje, o minister assisted to prescribe. But don't interfere with B. O B is fine. For B. O fine. They must not. Yes. O page. They must not interfere. But to me, Father, there was something else, a clarifier, a closer to that. It means we'll change the interest.
I suggest that while they are working on this one, Chairperson, we can continue,
yes,
because we are having a sitting at 2
yes.
o'clock.
Yes. Thanks, Chair. Yes. Yes, Lula.
D1, Roman Speaker 1.
Yeah. The position. Yes. But on 9, Paku Ford, a landlord's rights against a tenant include the right to prompt, you know, it's fine, this one. I want to check, does this clause try to put an offense. Is it an offense? It's not an offense. Okay, continue. Masien.
I'm not a law expert, but I just wanted to check something. I'm taking interest the way you are guiding this. Under 4BA, where it says an amount may not exceed an amount equivalent to an amount specified in the lease agreement or otherwise agreed to between the parties. In the current dispensation, normally they pay 1 month, a deposit equivalent to 1 month lease. But as it is here, it doesn't talk to that. It just says an amount that is either specified in the contract or agreed to between the parties. My question is, if I'm going to be paying 110,000 a month, and my landlord, because of demand, says he needs 50,000 deposit, does the law protect me from that, or which one is payable, the 50,000 that he wants, or the 10,000 equivalent to 1 month the rental fee? As it is stated,
on the issue of the amount of deposit, remember we've made provision, number one, that the minister, when it is social housing, number one, the minister can actually prescribe minimum deposit or maximum deposit. When it is private housing, that is not something, the discussion that we had from the committee was that the feeling was not to interfere in private housing to such an extent. However, we are making provision for norms and standards. So that is something that can be dealt with there. Also, your normal consumer rules will apply. And if the tenant doesn't want to agree to the deposit, he doesn't have to sign the agreement. But if he has agreed and the landlord then makes changes, that is something that the tribunal can deal with.
But I must correct you. Don't say we have said we don't interfere on the private. We do interfere. We said go and prepare something that is going to talk on the size and so on. Because even the private, we can't say we don't interfere. We are regulating the industry. We are regulating the industry. So we cannot accept where a private owner with two square meters. It's a private owner. It's a private owner. I charge R1,000. So how are you addressing that now? You are talking another language that we have not talked about. We need to address that language that we talked about. We are regulating the industry.
Jefferson, what I meant was that when we talked about with social housing, the deposit actually be restricted. That kind of restriction is not placed on the private sector. The private sector will be regulated through norms and standards. So there will be broader aspects set down by the minister through norms and standards that will deal with issues like deposit, size, rental, etc. But there's not going to be outright restrictions which will be done for social housing, where the minister will be able to say, you can only charge R10 per square meter. Things like that.
Listen, I just wanted to simplify it, to say, suppose, and I'll tell you the context where this happens. You know, the rights of tenants, to either agree or not to agree, it's correct to say that they've got the right. But let's look at a situation where in January students are flocking to Pretoria and they need accommodation at, say, next to the university, like Bekies. Accommodation is limited. The students' numbers are so many. So everyone wants to get accommodation so that they can just start classes. When a company that is administering accommodation there says, you will pay us, say, R5,000 for a single room, but we need 3 months in advance, so we need 15,000. And they've got a determination. I'm telling you reality because it happens to me.
These things do happen. Can you try and address that? Let's continue.
Jefferson, it is dealt with under norms and standards. because we've actually made provision where there are in certain geographical areas specific problems that can be dealt with in relation to that specific geographical area. In other words, where we're talking about students, and we know that this is a something that, that is prevalent in student areas, there is no rationale for 3 months' deposit to be requested, but it's not dealt with anywhere in the rest of the country, the minister can say, in respect of student housing, I am making the following standard, and that will then be dealt with under that. Chairman, we also have a proposal on the investment issue to read out.
No, Chair, the Act is very explicit. What I'm concerned about in this paragraph, as raised by Patrick, can't we just include or lesser agreed? So it doesn't allow the amount to exceed.
I think that although, but it must be clear what the other issues are going to be, because the OOE Act cannot be bloated. But it is important that issue raised of Philip, very crucial. There has to be an indication it is going to be addressed with regulations. Guys, not going to be put around.
It's not addressed in the regulation, Chairperson. It is a here, black and white, in section 4B, which is page 5, that deals with the rights and obligations of landlords. It's 4B sub 1. A landlord may require a tenant before moving into the dwelling to pay a deposit, which A, may not exceed an amount equivalent to the amount specified in the lease agreement. Whatever amount, if the lease agreement, the rental amount is 5,000, so the deposit will be 5,000. It may not exceed that amount. So it's already clarified here in the legislation.
Okay, for the sake of Comrade Bula.
And I think it would be correct then if you would say, or otherwise, that should be deleted. In view of what you are saying now, yes. Okay.
Okay, I think we can continue now in terms of we are behind in terms of time. Thanks. Continue, Kwezi.
Chairperson, if we can read out the proposal for paragraph B to be amended, so that paragraph B shall now read, a landlord may require a tenant before moving into the dwelling to pay a deposit which, paragraph B, must, dash, subparagraph 1, must be invested by the landlord in an interest-bearing account with a financial institution, provided that the rate applicable to such account may not be less than the rate applicable to a savings account with that financial institution. Or, subparagraph 2, under such circumstances as may be prescribed, be dealt with as prescribed. In other words, that allows for certain circumstances, the minister will prescribe by regulation that there are other measures to be implemented. It's on page 7, clause 7, amendment of section 5, and it reads as follows. Section 5 of the Principal Act is hereby amended, A, by the substitution for subsection 1 of the following subsection. And subsection 1 reads as follows. The landlord must reduce the, which is underlined, and in bold, we're omitting A. The landlord must reduce the lease entered into between himself and herself and a tenant to writing. I'm going to read only the one that is going to be carried out in the principal act. The bolds, we understand that they are going to be omitted. To writing, provided that the lease will not be subject to the provisions of the formalities in respect of leases of Land Act 1969, Act Number 18 of 1969. Paragraph B, by the substitution for subsection 2 of the following subsection. Subsection 2 must contain the information set out in subsection 6. C, by the substitution for subsection 3 of the following subsection, and reads as follows, a lease will be enforceable in a tribunal or competent court and will be deemed to include the rights and obligations of tenants and landlords, referred to in sections 4A and 4B, whether or not specifically incorporated. D, by the substitution in subsection 6 for paragraph B of the following paragraph B, the description of the dwelling which is the subject of the lease, provided that a street address will be sufficient. E, by the insertion in subsection 6 after paragraph F of the following paragraph. FA, a reference relating to the rights and obligations of the tenant and landlord as set out in sections 4A and 4B. F, by the substitution in subsection 6 for paragraph G of the following paragraph G, any other obligations of the tenant and the landlord not set out in sections 4A, 4B, or regulations relating to unfair practice. G, by the substitution in subsection 6 for paragraph H of the following paragraph. H, amount of any other charges payable in addition to the rental in respect of the rental housing property. Which other charges must be identified in the lease agreement? H, by the insertion of the following subsection after subsection 6, 6A, the minister must develop a pro forma lease agreement in all 11 official languages containing the minimum requirements as set out in this act, which may be used as a guideline by the tenants and the landlords. I, by the substitution for subsection 7 of the following subsection 7, a list of defects registered in terms of sections 4A, 5, and 4B, 4, must be attached as an annexure to the lease. And J, by the deletion of subsection 9. That's the end of clause 7.
7, the first one, 7A. The question now arises, as we say, like I asked the initially, what happens to the existing leases that are verbal and or written? Do we declare them invalid after the inception, or what do we do? Do we need to put a clause there for it, or will it be covered by the transition?
In the transitional provisions. Because this one is going forward from the date of commencement of the Act, this is going to be the position. Next clause is clause 8. It's substitution of section 6. Clause 8 reads as follows. The following section is hereby substituted for section 6 of the Principal Act. Its application of chapter, and it reads as follows. This chapter applies to all provinces in the Republic of South Africa. That is clause 8. Next clause is dealing with the substitution of section 7. The following section is hereby substituted for section 7 of the Principal Act. Establishment of rental housing tribunals. 7. Every MEC must, within the first financial year following the commencement of the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012, by notice in the Gazette, establish a tribunal in the province to be known as the Rental Housing Tribunal. That is clause 9. Clause 10. Amend section 9 of the Principal Act as follows. A, by the substitution for the heading of the following heading. Now it's going to read membership instead of composition of tribunal. Paragraph B, by the substitution for subsection 1 of the following subsection. 1, the tribunal consists of 4 or 7 members who are fit and proper persons appointed by the MEC and must comprise A, a chairperson who is suitably qualified and has the necessary expertise and exposure to rental housing matters.
These members who are appointed by the MEC, can we give the MEC the discretion to increase them their members? If in case, I'm just putting it across. Do we leave it to the MEC's discretion, or do we limit it to 4 or 7 members?
Once we say 4. We are also accommodating those smaller nyana areas, what we are saying 4. So when we say 7, it's a maximum. But I wanted to raise something here. You appoint the board in the national, who consult the portfolio committee. What do we say here? Why can't we put it here? Where is it? If it is there, because now, why can't we also insert it? Because it must be clear. Because the portfolio committee, I mean the standing committee of the provinces, as we are dealing, as we are doing here, they must be considered.
If we look at the Principal Act, Section 9, Subsection 2, says that the chairperson and the members of the tribunal must be appointed only after, paragraph A, the MECA through the media and by notice in the Gazette as they invited nominations of persons as candidates, B, the MECA has consulted with the relevant standing or portfolio committee of the provincial legislature, which is responsible for housing matters in the province.
Why can't you say who to extend this contemplated, include that section of the Principal Act? I don't know.
Because this is Section 9, Subsection 2, is part of the Principal Act. Here we're dealing with Subsection 1. And B, by the substitution for Subsection 1 of the following subsection, was in paragraph B, 3 or 6 members, of whom Roman 1, 1 in respect of 3 members and 2 in respect of 6 members shall be persons with expertise in rental housing, property management or housing development matters. Roman 2, 1 in respect of 3 members and 2 in respect of 6 members shall be persons with expertise in consumer matters pertaining to rental housing or housing development matters. And Roman 3, 1 in respect of 3 members and 2 in respect of 6 members shall be persons with legal qualification and legal expertise. Paragraph C, by this insertion after subsection 1A of the following subsections, 1B, the members of the tribunal must be broadly representative in terms of gender, race, and disability. 1C, the tribunal may function as 2 committees, each with 3 members, with the expertise set out in subsection 1B, Roman 1, 2, and 3, respectively, and with one committee being chaired by the chairperson and the other by the deputy chairperson. D, by the substitution in subsection 2 for paragraph B of the following paragraph B, the MEC has consulted with the relevant standing or portfolio committee of the provincial legislature, which is responsible for human settlement matters in the province. E, by the substitution for subsection 3 of the following subsection, the MEC may appoint up to 6 persons to serve as alternate members of the tribunal in the absence of any member referred to in paragraph B of subsection 1, but such persons must have the relevant expertise contemplated in paragraph B, Roman 1, 2, 3 of subsection 1, respectively, and must serve as an alternate for a member with similar expertise. And paragraph F, by the insertion after subsection 4 of the following subsections. 4A, a person appointed in terms of subsection 4 may not serve for more than 2 consecutive terms. 4B, succession plans must be adopted and must provide for replacement of members in such a manner that, for the sake of continuity, all members are not replaced at once. 4C, members already appointed at the time of commencement of the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012 and who have already served 2 consecutive terms may be reappointed for an additional term of not more than 18 months to ensure continuity. Clause 11, it amends Section 10 of the Principal Act as follows. Paragraph A, by the substitution for subsection 1, of the following subsection 1, the tribunal must meet on such days and during such hours and at such place as the chairperson of the tribunal may determine after consultation with other members of the tribunal. B, by the insertion after subsection 1 of the following subsection 1A, the tribunal may, subject to subsection 5, arrange 2 separate but simultaneous meetings of its 2 committees for purposes of effective functioning. And C, by the substitution for subsection 5 of the following subsection, the quorum of any meeting of the tribunal is 3 members, of which 1 must be a member appointed in terms of section 9.1b, Roman 3. That is clause 11.
Next clause is clause 12, amend section 13 of the Principal Act as follows: A, by the substitution in subsection 4C for the words preceding subparagraph 1 of the following words, make any other ruling that is just and fair to terminate any unfair practice, including without detracting from the generality of the aforegoing, a ruling to discontinue amongst others but not limited to. B, by the substitution in subsection 5 for paragraph A of the following paragraph: A, prevailing economic conditions. C, by the substitution for subsection 11 of the following subsection 11, the tribunal must, within 30 days of receipt of a complaint, refer any matter that relates to eviction to a competent court.
Getting the chair. This one, I would want to ask, shouldn't we say that the tribunal should refer the parties to the court? Because if it would not be the tribunal per se that will be going to court for an eviction. If we are saying it's the tribunal, then we must say the tribunal must apply to court. So it's twofold. If it's the tribunal, we must say the tribunal must apply to court. If it's them referring the matter to the competent court, then they must, it must read that the parties refer the parties to the court. The parties, meaning the tenant and the landlord, to the court, not them referring the matter.
Yes. Jefferson, I think maybe Chrissy can assist us on what happens in practice, but I know that there is the possibility where one institution can refer an application received by them to another institution. And I think this is what is intended here. In other words, the application as is before the tribunal will, by the secretariat of the tribunal, be sent to the High Court. And there it will be entered by the clerk, by the registrar, sorry, of the High Court. It will be allocated a case number, and the parties can then approach the registrar to put it on the roll for continuation. So wording it like this means that they don't have to start from scratch. The application that's before the tribunal is then deemed to be the motion or the summons in terms of the High Court rules. It won't be necessary. Because it's worded like this, it means simply the tribunal takes the application received on the prescribed forms and they send those forms. Yes, the application received by the complainant, whatever response was done on that, when the tribunal sees those documents before it and it realizes, oh, this is an eviction case, they take those documents and they hand them to the High Court in the area. They are not the, no, they're not applying on behalf. It's simply a referral of the application received.
Refer. Once you refer. They refer the matter.
If we say they must refer the parties, that means that the parties must start from scratch. If we say they refer the matter, it means that the matter is acknowledged as being in existence, even though it is filed at the wrong body. Because that's actually what is the problem. The tribunal can't hear it. So it's the incorrect body that it's filed at. So they simply take the matter and they refer that to the High Court. Of course, in practice, they'll have to tell the parties, listen, you now need to go to the court, your matter is there, it will be allocated a case number, and you'll continue the matter in court.
Thank you.
Paragraph D, by the division in subsection 12 of the word and at the end of paragraph B and the insertion in that subsection of the following paragraphs. D, subject to subsection 5, make a ruling to compel payment of rent as described and contracted to in a lease and area rentals in respect of any other matter over which it has jurisdiction. Make any order that is necessary to give effect to this act. And E, by the insertion after subsection 12 of the following subsections, 12A, the tribunal may on its own accord and at the request of one of its members or on application by any affected person, resign and or vary or any of its rulings if such rulings, A, were erroneously sought or granted in the absence of the person affected by it, B, condemn an ambiguity or patent error or omission, but only to the extent of clarifying that ambiguity or correcting that error or omission, or were granted as a result of a mistake common to all parties to the proceedings. 12B, the tribunal may act on its own accord when supplementing or amending accessory or consequential matters, including A, costs orders, B, altering an order for cost where it was made without hearing the parties, C, interest on ruling debts, D, clarifying of a ruling so as to give effect to the tribunal's through intention, and E, correcting clerical, arithmetical, or other errors in its ruling, provided that any substantive change to a ruling must be made within 14 days of the ruling being made. 12C, an application.
Let me ask that in terms of 12A, where does it cover the issue of evidence, if evidence is furnished? Is there somewhere in this legal semantics where it says if evidence is furnished, then the tribunal can do whatever they would like to do, rescind their decision or... If evidence is furnished.
Chairperson, I think that is covered in 12C, because what will happen in order to activate 12A, you must bring an application. 12C says the application for rescission must be brought within 14 days. So it doesn't specifically say you must bring an application and it must look as follows, but there will be an application, like we say in 12A, on application by any affected person. Now, a person, when they bring an application, they need to provide evidence. They can't just say, please change this order for me. They would have to say, this order was made, the following mistake was detected, this is why the mistake was there, et cetera, et cetera. Please correct the mistake. So that is not specifically stated there, but also in our regulations, we provide that the minister may prescribe the proceedings, prescribe the processes that must be followed in the tribunal. So the minister can then by regulation say, you know, when you bring an application for review, this and this and this must be done.
Honourable Mkhalapa, are you not happy because it's saying 12C covers the whole issues that have been raised in 12A and B, to say an application for rescission or variation must be brought within 14 days of the ruling being received by the affected person. So I think it's... What evidence? I think this clause is fine. If you want to explore, you can explore that through regulations. But now I think this it clarifies everything. You cannot just apply if you, for the sake of, you can't bring. Even if your facts are wrong, you have got facts. Those facts have to be proven by that tribunal.
Okay. Then the next one is clause 13. It amends section 14 of the Principal Act as follows: A, by the substitution for subsection 1 of the following subsection. 1. Every local municipality must establish a rental housing information office to advise tenants and landlords with regard to their rights and obligations in relation to dwellings within its area of jurisdiction, provided that the local municipalities may combine the functions of the rental housing information office with an existing office, and B, by the substitution for subsection 2 of the following subsection 2, every local municipality may, subject to the laws governing the appointment of local government officials appoint or designate officials to carry out any duties pertaining to such rental housing information office. That is clause 13. Clause 14 amends section 15 as follows. A, by the substitution in subsection 1 for the words preceding paragraph A of the following words. Subject to subsection 3, the minister may make regulations after consultation with the relevant parliamentary committees and every MEC by notice in the Gazette relating to paragraph B.
Chairperson, the issue with the May was that some of the regulations deals with, for instance, paragraph A reads anything which may or must be prescribed under chapter 4. So what we have done is the general section, section 1, reads may. Then we've added a clause, and Bongi will still get to that, where we say certain regulations must be made and we provide a period. That is on page 11, row 5. Subsection 3 now reads, the minister must issue regulations as contemplated in subsection 1B, if and if A, within 12 months of the commencement of the Rental Housing Amendment Act.
Related to the implementation of this Act, why do we have a set of regulations, different set of regulations?
The idea is that Section 15 deals with quite a number of issues. Amongst others, anything which may or must be prescribed. It deals with procedures, the forms and certificates, and then by the minister. Must be by the minister. And then it ends with anything which is necessary to prescribe in order to achieve the purposes of this Act. Now, if you put must, it means that the minister must issue something in order to put, for instance, this paragraph G, which is necessary to prescribe in order to achieve the purposes of this Act. And any member of the public can take the minister to court and ask for a mandamus, forcing the minister to issue some regulations which might not, the minister might say, but I don't know what to issue on this. So therefore we made it may. But then we are saying, in respect of paragraph B, the procedures, the manner in which the proceedings of the tribunal must be conducted, as well as the norms and standards, as well as unfair practices. Those three sets of regulations must be issued, and they must be issued within 12 months of the commencement of this Act. So those are the three identified as being absolutely crucial for implementation of this Act. Now, the minister can do that in one regulation, or he can issue three or two or sets of regulations to deal with that. Listen, if we can read the section, if you read section 1 and we just take paragraph G, let's insert must, and you'll see that it doesn't make sense. If we say, subject to subsection 3, the minister must make regulations after consultation with the relevant parliamentary committees and every MEC by notice in the Gazette relating to anything which is necessary to prescribe in order to achieve the purposes of this Act. You're finding yourself with a conundrum whether the minister must now issue something, but we're not telling him what it is that he must issue on. So for that purpose, and because you need that paragraph, because something might come up in 2 years' time that we don't know of yet, so we are saying the minister is allowed, because remember the minister must be delegated the authority to make regulations by Parliament before he's allowed to make regulations. So we need to cater for unforeseen circumstances in future, therefore we're making it may. But then we have looked at the issues that must be, where there must be regulations, and we specified them in a new section, subsection 3. And the three that were identified was the unfair practices, the norms and standards, and the proceedings of the tribunal, because those were the three
must have regulations.
Let me ask on 14B, the procedure and manner in which proceedings of the tribunal must be conducted, including circumstances. Are we going to specify circumstances or what? Because if I don't want... Because of we can't over-regulate on what circumstances. It's either we specify what circumstances or we delete it.
Jameson, the inclusion of circumstances specifically relates to an appeal. The concern that the committee had was that we are now providing for an appeal, but what if this appeal is abused? So that the landlord, for instance, for the tiniest thing, runs and opens an appeal simply to prolong the proceedings and thereby actually getting rid of the tenant. Because if the tenant has to wait another 30 days, he might as well find another accommodation. So, but you also need this appeal process because the landlord might go to the court. So as a compromise, we've indicated that the minister will have to probably consult with the tribunals specifically and find out where are appeals emanating, what type of things are being appealed. And then in the regulations we'll say an appeal may be lodged under the following circumstances. One, where an order was given for attachment. B, where an order was something like that.
It should be clarified in the regulations because you don't want to say you're giving an open blanket, you know, to the minister to say which specific circumstances. Circumstances might vary. I would say that by virtue of us having an appeal process, no one would want to go through that process for just going through it for emotions. So we got to be careful that we don't over-regulate what circumstances.
As prescribed by the regulation.
Exactly.
As prescribed by the regulation.
We remove the circumstances, we're saying as prescribed by regulation.
Hmm. We are in 4CB.
But this is an empowering provision. If you look at Section 15 of the Act, it empowers the minister to do regulations. And it says the minister must make regulations relating to, and then you go to paragraph B, relating to the procedures and the manner in which the proceedings of the tribunal must be conducted. And then this, the including circumstances and the processes. That one is relating to the appeals. Because I'm going to take you through to the appeals provisions in page 11, because they read together. In page 11, section 17A, subsection 2, is saying the minister must prescribe the circumstances under which an application for appeal may be submitted. So there will be certain circumstances under which you may apply for an appeal. The minister will prescribe that.
No, that's what you're saying. You say you remove circumstances and you put regulations. Under regulations. The initial, at 12C, the chairperson said, as prescribed by regulations. So I'm just saying, as prescribed by regulations, we also put it at 18.2 to remove circumstances. Because of when you say circumstances, I think you are being too prescriptive. It's too wide. But if you say regulations, then you know the minister will be putting those regulations on what processes to follow. So you just remove circumstances and you say regulations.
There are so many circumstances.
Yeah, there are so many.
There are many circumstances, yes. That's my job. After we adopt the legislation, I can. No. We are done now.
We are done.
This is your legislation. We are done now. Come to the Wamba. They are going to the legislation. So go come and say, Japan, go go go. Before I got to.
No. But this is the regulation section. We cannot say as prescribed in the regulation because this section, the one that we are amending, is a regulation section. So you need to specify.
Okay.
You cannot just give a minister a blanket discretion. You specify the instances whereby you clarify what instances must the minister make regulations upon.
It is going to be specified in the regulation. So this section, it deals with the regulation. So there is no need to repeat it. Yes. So we are in agreement on that one. Let's put it on our record that we are going to watch this, because the regulation quest won them as early as yesterday. Otherwise, we're supposed to continue the legislation. The regulations are here. But we have given an opportunity to say, by the time we finish this, through this section of the NCOP, the regulations may have been written. Yeah.
Paragraph F, Chairperson. By the insertion in subsection 1 after paragraph F of the following paragraphs, that is paragraph FA, norms and standards that are aligned to the policy framework set out in section 2.3 in relation to terms and conditions of the lease, specifically in relation to fairness and protection of the parties. 2, safety, health and hygiene. 3, basic living conditions, including access to basic amenities. 4, size. 5, overcrowding. And Roman 6, affordability. Provided that such norms and standards may be set per geographical area to avoid unfair practices particular to that area. FB, the calculation methods for escalation of rental amounts and the maximum rate of deposits in rental housing options provided by the social housing institutions or other delivery agents and funded by the public funds as contemplated in the Social Housing Act 2008, Act Number 16 of 2008. FC, the offences referred to in Section 16. And G, by the insertion of the subsection 2 of the following subsection. 3, the minister...
How do you accommodate the small scale, whatever, or informal? Where is it? Because these norms and standards, now you are saying they are referring to EE, social housing and other delivery agents, and funded by the public funds. So, la area they see even too many discussion.
Chairperson, subsection F capital B only relates to social housing. So in that instance, the minister can make regulations dealing with social housing. In section, in subsection F, yes, but this relates specifically to maximum deposits and rental. Then on F capital A, these norms and standards will relate to private as well as social. They cut across the board, and they go from your almost like 100,000 rentals per month to your 500 rand rentals per month.
Clause 15, amendment of chapters 4 and 5. Chapters 4 and 5 of the Principal Act are hereby amended by deleting section 15 from chapter 4 and inserting it under chapter 5 before section 16. Clause 16 amends section 16 of the Principal Act by the substitution for paragraph A of the following paragraph, and A fails to comply with sections 4 or 5.1. B, by the insertion after paragraph A of the following paragraphs. A, capital A, willfully or in a grossly negligent manner interferes with the rights of the tenant and landlord set out in sections 4A, 4A1, 3, 7, 8, and 9. And section 4B, 8, 9B, 9C, 9D, Roman 1. A, capital letter B, willfully or grossly negligently fails to fulfill his or her obligations as landlord in terms of sections 4B1 and section 11, respectively. C, by the substitution for paragraph G of the following paragraph, fails to comply with any ruling of the tribunal. That is clause 16. It's not section. 17, substitute section 17 of the Principal Act and reads as follows. Review, without prejudice to the constitutional right of any person to gain access to a court of law, the proceedings of a tribunal, including an appeal in terms of section 17A, may be brought under review before the High Court within its area of jurisdiction. Next, clause 18 inserts the section 17A. That deals with appeals. Section 17A reads as follows. Any person who feels aggrieved by the decision of the tribunal may, in writing and within 21 days of receipt of the decision, file an appeal against that decision with the secretariat of the tribunal appointed in terms of section 11.1.
Let's ask that one. 11.1, does it mean of this act or 11.1 of the Public Service Act? What do we mean by 11.1? On the appointment of the secretariat.
11.1 of this act, because we are talking about this amendment act, the reference to this act. If it was another legislation, we would have specified that legislation.
Chairperson, if we can maybe just read 11.1. It says, the staff required for the proper performance of the tribunal's functions and administration of this act must be appointed subject to the laws governing the public service. So the staff will be appointed in terms of the Public Service Act, but what we are referring to here is Section 11.1 of this Act, the Rental Housing Act.
The minister must prescribe the circumstances under which an application for appeal may be submitted, including the procedure for filing and hearing of an appeal. The secretariat must appoint a panel of adjudicators who possess legal qualifications and expertise in rental housing matters or consumer matters that relate to rental housing.
Shouldn't we say the secretariat in consultation with the MEC or the DG? Will it be a secretariat alone just appointing those adjudicators, or how does it work? Because at the end of the day, the MEC is the political head of this.
What will happen here is that your accounting officer for the provincial department will delegate an authority to the secretariat. That delegation will have the conditions under which they will be able to do that.
In consultation with the DG, the accounting officer, then, because you can't leave it to the secretariat alone just to appoint the adjudicators. Because of somehow it goes to the accounting officer, who's the DG, or it goes to the political head, who's the MEC.
No, I think it's true, because it is a delegated authority. I think it must be clear that it is a delegated authority. They cannot just do it on their own, because people can take chances. I don't know.
I'm not sure. Maybe the department can clarify, because this, I've drafted this in consultation with them. The understanding I got was when the secretariat is appointing the mediators and conciliators in terms of this act, they do it on their own without the consultation of the MEC. So I followed the same approach. Perhaps the department can clarify that I don't have a problem if we insert the consultation of the MEC, but I'm guided.
Chair, I think. Yeah, Chair. Yes, I think in response. respect of this particular piece of legislation and also in terms of the amendment, if you have a look at 17.1A, it says the secretariat of the tribunal appointed in terms of Section 11.1. If you go to the Principal Act, Principal Act talks about the staff of the of the tribunal, which will of course include the secretariat. And the secretariat, any person appointed in terms of that particular section must be issued with a certificate of appointment by the head of that particular department. So it is. Yes, Chair, people who are appointed, all the staff that are appointed under Section 11 will be appointed by the head of the department and they will be issued with the certificate thereof.
Okay.
Then in principle it means to say that, meaning that they can carry their particular function. Because the certificate will clearly indicate to say that what will be the delegation, what will be the function. And they will be appointed by the head of the department, meaning that the head of the department will know.
Chair, I take the point, but in light of what you said, just to avoid abuse, we should say in consultation with the DG, who is the accounting officer of the province. Yeah, or the accounting officer, because you can't leave it alone to the secretariat to make this decision. Even if they are appointed under the Public Service Section 11.
Let's wait. The decision has been taken by the tribunal. They are implementing the decision.
When that secretariat is appointed, he's given a certificate which will clarify as to what is it that is giving him or her the authority, delegated function, as to what is it that is expected of him to do.
And to my man, the secretariat, I know really it's okay. It's actually a decision. Come on, can I make a decision? Yeah, tribunal. The tribunal has decided, has received this, because this application has to come to the chairperson of the tribunal. I don't know which needs to shape a lot. It has to come to the chairperson of the tribunal. And then the chairperson of the tribunal discussed that. Can just introduce that to the tribunal and then process it. Even just not to say in a formal meeting, but there has to be a notice that there's this appeal. All members must be aware that there's this appeal process that is going to be undertaken. And then hand it over, delegate it over. The process is off because the politicians, because these tribunals act as politicians, so they cannot appoint.
Of the adjudicators by the secretariat. I'm just saying the secretariat alone cannot do that duty. He must consult the accounting officer on the appointment of the adjudicator, not on the appeal process.
The politicians don't have to be part. Politicians don't have to be part of that process. Yes, he is an accounting officer. He can. So that is why we are saying the secretariat is acting under the accounting office. The one for human department, a co-officer, official, something without the authority from the. No, it can't happen like that. Let's adopt this way. It can't happen like that. There is an accounting office. No, Chairperson, we don't have to.
Yeah,
we don't.
I wanted to say that because there will be no need to give that that secretariat a certificate with that delegated authority if we say in consultation.
No, let's leave it. Let's try it. If they abuse, they will observe that. But I don't think even in the National Department. Because at the end of the day, if the accounting officer will crucify even by the PMSA. Continue.
Because I was going to say on this argument
doesn't Section 11, subsection 4 of the Act cover what we are talking about? Maybe the legal people can say so.
We have agreed, Mama, we have taken it back to say we are comfortable.
You are
covered, yes, ma'am.
Okay. I am also, if you are.
Thank you, Mama.
Sub 4, when appeals are lodged in terms of this section, the Secretariat must within one day of receipt of the appeal select one or two adjudicators from the panel on a rotation basis to consider appeals and must so refer the appeals for hearing. Sub 5, when an appeal has been lodged, the operation and execution of the order in question shall be suspended pending the outcome of the appeal. 6, the appeal must be finalized within 30 days of referral by the Secretariat. 7, the adjudicators may refer the matter back to the tribunal or confirm, certify, or amend the decision. That is clause 18. Clause 19 is the one that is substituting certain expression. The principal act is hereby amended by the substitution for the expression local authority, wherever it occurs, of the expression local municipality. 20, transitional provisions. Any additional or amended obligations imposed upon a landlord or tenant by the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012 shall become effective within 12 months from the date of commencement of the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012. 21, this act is called the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012 and comes into operation on a date determined by the President by proclamation and the Gazette.
We are adopting, can we adopt this with amendments?
Sure, with amendments, but what we will do is we as the DA will reserve our rights because we have to canvass this to the caucus. So we'll see it in the National Assembly. No, the whole thing. We'll see, don't worry, we'll see it at the National Assembly when...
Chairperson, no, don't worry. It's their duty. Can we, he has adopted with amendments. The seconder, in the House, we know they will tell send different from what we're doing here.
Adoption, Chair.
We know.
But Chair, why waste enough time to deal with this when people will not adopt it?
Don't panic.
Can I read this? The report of the Portfolio Committee on Human Settlements, B21/2011, National Assembly, Section 76, dated 23rd May 2012. The Portfolio Committee on Human Settlements, having considered the subject of the Rental Housing Amendment Bill, B21/2011, National Assembly, Section 76, referred to it and classified by the joint tagging mechanism, as the Section 76 bill presents a revised bill B12-1B, 2011, report to be considered. I thank you. Yes, it's B21B.